we're talking about how to solve our climate crisis and the role of the fossil fuel industry. We spend the hour with climatologist Michael Mann here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the climate scientist who gave us the hockey stick graph in the late 90s. The graph showed world temperatures essentially flat for hundreds of years, and then boom, they shoot up dramatically during the 1900s due to our carbon dioxide emissions. That's the blade of the stick, if you will. And now there are new, more subtle tactics and political headwinds, even COVID interfering with climate action. What do you want to know about how to solve this crisis? Email ideas at WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Michael Mann directs the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University, where he's a distinguished professor of atmospheric science. He's written 5 books on climate change. His new one is called The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Michael, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much, Kate. It's great to be with you.
Well, when you call efforts to solve the climate crisis as being at war, that's a jarring word, very strong emotional implications. Why do you call climate change a war?
Well, it's not a war that we've elected to be in. Keep that in mind. Unfortunately, there has been a very well-funded effort by fossil fuel interests and those promoting their agenda to discredit or seek to discredit the science of climate change, to attack the scientists, to do everything within their power to prevent us from transitioning away from our reliance on fossil fuels, because, of course, they're making billions of dollars of profit every year that we remain addicted to fossil fuels. And so they've used very insidious and underhanded tactics to prevent us from moving on, and at the expense of all of us and at the expense of the planet. It's similar to what the tobacco industry did decades ago. In fact, it's essentially the same playbook. And so, you know, you can't really prevail in a battle if you refuse to accept that you're in one. And we are in one with the most well-funded, well-organized opponent in the history of human civilization, the fossil fuel industry and those promoting their agenda.
Yeah, you described this new climate war as made up of downplayers, deflectors, dividers, delayers, doomers. What is different this time versus what you saw decades ago in how we looked at climate change?
Yeah, and so, you know, the nature of this war has evolved. The old climate war was more or less along the lines of what I was describing before, an effort to discredit the scientific evidence that climate change is actually happening. Well, that's really no longer credible because we can all see that it's happening. The impacts of climate change have just become too obvious, too profound to deny. That doesn't mean that the forces of inaction, as I call them, the inactivists, have given up in their effort to prevent action. Instead, they've turned to these other tactics that you mentioned. One of the primary tactics is indeed the effort to divide the climate advocacy community, to get us fighting with each other so that we don't present a unified front and a demand for change. And there are a number of insidious tactics that they've turned to. That's one of them. And of course, we can get into the details of all of them.
Yeah, you've called this a wedge issue, you know, division being here a role. What do you see there in terms of trying to divide people, industry, individual action, and other aspects of how we could, you know, take the lead in terms of what scientists are telling us?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the, again, the primary tactics has been to divide us. And perhaps the easiest way to divide us is to get us to fight with each other over our individual lifestyle choices, over our carbon purity. You're not doing enough. You know, you should be, you should go to a vegan diet. You shouldn't fly anymore. Sort of behavior shaming. And so that generates, of course, lots of friction and division, and it you know, is promoted by state actors, the same state actors like Russia that tried to interfere with our past two presidential elections, have actually used bot armies and trolls online to generate this sort of discord among climate advocates, get them fighting with each other. And by the way, if you divert attention to individual behavior, changing our diet, changing our lifestyle, you make the climate problem sound like the solution is entirely one of individual behavior. That's also a very effective tactic because it deflects attention away from the need for policy change, for systemic changes. It deflects it to simply human behavior, individual behavior. And at the same time, if you can tar some of the leading climate advocates like Al Gore or Leonardo DiCaprio by focusing on their supposed lifestyle excesses and you sort of portray them as hypocrites, that sort of undercuts their effectiveness as messengers. So all of these tactics sort of are synergistic in a way, and they're part of a very concerted effort to prevent us from moving on.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Michael Mann, author of The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Are you getting more concerned about our changing climate? Are you hopeful or pessimistic that we humans will be able to stop this? What policies are you looking for that President-elect Biden and Congress could enact to stop climate change? You can join in, email ideas at WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Michael, at the beginning of the book, you quote this internal ExxonMobil document from the 70s that notes that once the effects of climate change become measurable, quote, they might not be reversible. Do you think that fossil fuel companies, oil companies, have known for decades that climate change is real?
They have. And here, once again, it sort of mirrors past disinformation campaigns. The tobacco industry knew all the way back in the 1950s that their product was incredibly addictive and deadly. And rather than own up to that, they instead engaged in a decades-long massive disinformation campaign, which involved discrediting independent scientists, medical scientists who had established the same thing, and fooling the public and policymakers and forestalling any efforts to regulate their product. Well, that playbook was appropriated by the fossil fuel industry, and the same effort to deny the science, to attack the science, was underway even as their own scientists, once again, just like the tobacco industry, as revealed by these internal memos, documents that were eventually released. Their own scientists referred to the potential impacts as catastrophic. And so there is a deep immorality here in the behavior of these bad actors. And if we had acted decades ago when the evidence was already clear, it would have been a much easier solution. Now we have to decarbonize our global economy within the next decade if we're going to have a chance of keeping warming below truly catastrophic levels.
We have Penn State climate scientist Michael Mann telling us what forces are working against trying to stabilize our planet. His new book is called The New Climate War. How much faith do you have that scientists and industry and government can work together to take us off a catastrophic trajectory? What climate data is confusing to you? What do you want clarity on? Pose it to the atmospheric science professor. Email ideas at WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Back in a minute with Michael Mann here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the war on climate change and what the fossil fuel industry has to do with it. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. However you want to say it, we are at a critical juncture, a tipping point, the dawn of a new era, perhaps, with the Biden administration's environmental commitments, a unique moment in history. Climatologist Michael Mann watches all of it. He writes, the answer is that there is no path of escape from climate change catastrophe that doesn't involve policies aimed at societal decarbonization. What policies are you hoping that come from President-elect Biden and Congress? On the home front, how confident are you in Wisconsin realizing 100% carbon-free electricity in the next 3 decades? What technology do you hope can help solve this? Join in, email ideas at WPR.org. Michael Mann's new book is called The New Climate War, and he stays with us. Michael, let's go back to the 70s and look closer at the Native American deflection campaign. And you really take apart this campaign from the 70s because you saw how it shamed people to stop polluting. Can you remind us what these ads were?
Sure thing. And in fact, you know, I was taken in myself. It was only relatively recently, as I was writing this book, that I became aware of how insidious that particular public service announcement actually was. Those among your listeners who were sort of my generation or close to it may remember this commercial, this public service announcement that ran in the early 1970s. A Native American in full headdress rowing down this river that's strewn with bottle and can litter, eventually comes to the embankment, gets out of the river. There's a highway next to it, and a passing car throws a bag of trash that lands at his feet, and then the camera pans to his face, and you see a single tear dropping down from his face with the tagline or the voiceover saying, you know, people cause pollution, only people can fix it, or something like that. It was extremely effective. I would say it felt empowering. As a child at the time, it raised awareness about the problem of pollution. It seemed to empower us that we could solve this problem. It was sort of a feel good, in a sense, sort of campaign, because it was, you know, it did feel like it was empowering a whole generation of people. But ironically, it was actually a propaganda campaign that had been hatched on Madison Avenue by Coca-Cola and the beverage industry. And they had even conned a number of environmental organizations into co-sponsoring this ad, which appeared under the auspices of the Ad Council that puts out many of these sorts of PSAs. And instead, what they were really trying to do was to deflect attention away from bottle bills. The various states, including the state Massachusetts that I grew up in, were in the process of passing bottle bills that would put deposits on bottles and cans. It would require the beverage industry to process that those returned bottles and cans, and it would hurt their bottom line. It would cut into their profits. They didn't want that to happen. They didn't want bottle bills breaking out among the states. They certainly didn't want a national bottle bill. And so they ran this campaign, this propaganda campaign, the Crying Indian commercial, which was intended to deflect attention away from the need for those sorts of systemic solutions to individuals. It's just about you and me being better citizens,
shifting the blame.
Shifting the blame, absolutely, from industry to individuals, and at the same time, in essence, suppressing enthusiasm for those systemic solutions, those policies that they didn't want to see pass.
You mentioned here bottle deposits, bottle legislation. How has that type of policy played out over the decades, and what is it like currently? You know, what states have bottle deposits?
Yeah, only 13 states of the 50 have bottle bills, and those are mostly deep blue states like Massachusetts and Oregon and Washington. So there is no national bottle bill on the horizon. And ironically, this has given rise to one of our other great global environmental problems. Your listeners may have heard about the global plastic pollution problem, plastic, microplastic, now found at the bottom of the deepest part of our oceans, the Marianas Trench. And just recently, there was an article actually just a couple weeks ago, or a study and a fairly widespread media coverage. Microplastics are now found in the placenta of human mothers and mother's milk. We have the beverage industry in large part and their deflection campaign to thank for that.
We're talking with Michael Mann, director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State, where he's a professor of atmospheric science, looking at the effects of climate change over the decades and what can be done today, and taking your questions about climate change and how different factions are working against climate action. You can email ideas at WPR.org, tweet us at WPR Mornings. Michael, how has your personal research been affected by climate deniers, by industry? The work you do started decades ago. I'm not going to date you, but you know, you are the hockey stick graph person. You will forever be the hockey stick person. How has your world been affected, your science?
Well, you know, the attacks against the hockey stick that began decades ago, when it became this iconic symbol in the climate change debate, led me down a completely different career path from the one that I thought I had signed up for when I double majored in applied math and physics in college, went off to graduate school to study theoretical physics and then climate science. Little did I think that I could end up in the center of one of the most contentious societal debates that we've ever had. But because of this graph that we published and the you know, the iconic significance that it took on, I did find myself at the center of this very fractious debate. And over time, I've come to embrace that role, even though it's not the role that I signed up for. It's not the role that I was trained for. I can think of no greater privilege, to be perfectly honest, than to be in a position to influence the conversation about what is arguably the greatest challenge, the greatest threat that we face as a civilization. And so I, in a sense, I suppose I should thank my detractors, those who attacked me in the hockey stick, because it's given me a platform to do everything I can to make sure that we don't degrade this planet for my daughter, for our children and grandchildren, future generations.
We have an email here, Matt in Wausau, email to say that the reality of climate change is that half of us didn't believe in science. Republicans, Matt says, need to buy into the science or nothing will change. How much of this climate war is politically partisan, politically driven?
Well, you know, we've really been given a window into the politicization of science and how vested interests and ideologues will skew science and undermine science and the communication of science when it conflicts with their agenda. We've seen that play out in an obviously devastating and disastrous way over the last year here with the attack by the outgoing Trump administration and those promoting the Trump administration, the attack on the basic public health science behind COVID-19. And I know Wisconsin, like our state, Pennsylvania, has certainly suffered the consequences of, at times, fairly large contingents of the population not observing the public health guidelines, social distancing, mask wearing. And we can literally measure the toll of that anti-science campaign in lost human lives. Now, in lost hundreds of thousands of lost human lives in the United States and what could ultimately get into the millions. That is perhaps a window. If there's a silver lining in this, it's that maybe this has given us a window into the deadly consequences of anti-science, of ignoring what science has to tell us about the risks that we face, because ultimately climate change is an even greater crisis. We'll get past the coronavirus crisis. A year from now, it will largely be in our rearview mirror, although for some, obviously, who've lost loved ones and are suffering permanent health consequences, there will still be a residual impact. But in a collective sense, we'll move beyond this crisis, but there's an even greater crisis that looms in the background, and that's climate change. And maybe this gives us a window into just how dangerous and deadly anti-science is.
Or
and maybe
perhaps some
it will bring
humility.
Along some folks.
Yeah, perhaps yeah. Some humility that we can't actually rule the natural world.
Well, that's right, Kate. I mean, I think more than anything else, it's taught us about our fragility, that, you know, this microscopic organism could essentially bring human civilization down on its feet. It tells us that, you know, on a finite planet with finite food and water and space, and nearly 8 billion people now competing for those finite resources, we really have to think deeply about the sustainability of our life on this planet, because we are coming into conflict with fundamental planetary boundaries.
Penn State Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science Michael Mann with us. Is net zero emissions confusing or difficult to connect to your personal life? Have you stopped buying from certain companies due to their environmental tactics or lack of effort to solve this crisis? Which ones do you avoid? What do you want out of government and industry? Email ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll pick this up after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're spending the hour with the climate scientist who brought us the hockey stick graph back in the late 90s. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Back then, it was a dire warning on the growing effects of CO2 in our atmosphere. Fast forward to today, and Michael Mann views climate change as an all-out war that is winnable. He writes, "Climate deniers are increasingly a fringe element, and we must spend our time on people who are reachable, teachable, and movable. They need assistance." Are you an optimist or pessimist on meeting climate targets? Do you discuss climate change with family and friends? How do those conversations go? Email ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We have Penn State climatologist Michael Mann, who stays with us. We heard from Christopher in Port Wing, who emailed and says, Christopher thinks there needs to be a narrative shift. They think we need to tell a positive narrative of the huge economic benefit that transitioning to clean energy can have, with jobs, with better food systems. What do you see in how we frame this crisis?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, we are moving past outright denial, as that's the thesis of the book, indeed, as it just becomes no longer credible to deny that climate change is happening. And we are encountering these other tactics by the forces of inaction, the inactivists, to stop us from moving forward. But at the same time, I argue in the closing chapter of the book that there's really an alignment of a number of positive factors that really place us in perhaps the best position we've been in yet to actually see the action that's necessary. And it's a variety of factors. It's, first of all, the fact that climate change is no longer debatable. It's very obvious, not only that it's happening, but it's having quite adverse consequences. The unprecedented heat waves and wildfires and floods and superstorms that we've seen in recent years are a reminder of the fact that, by some measure, dangerous climate change is already here, and it's a matter of how bad we're willing to let it get. But counterbalancing that are a number of things. First of all, the latest science tells us that, yes, there's urgency, but there's also agency. We now understand that if we stop burning carbon, you know, full stop, the temperature of the planet, the surface temperature of the planet, stops increasing very quickly within a matter of years. And so there's an immediate and direct impact of the actions that we take. And that's, you know, that is very empowering. We have this global youth climate movement, in a sense, led by my friend Greta Thunberg, who was kind enough to provide a blurb for the book. And that movement has really centered this issue where it needed to be all along, because this isn't just about science and economics and policy and politics. It's about ethics, intergenerational ethics, our obligation not to degrade this planet for future generations. And as the caller mentions, we're in a position now to see action in the United States because of the latest election, with a Democratic president who campaigned on climate, has a has a mandate to move forward on climate. It is already incorporating it into the structure of this new administration in a profound way. A Democratic Congress now that will be able to advance climate legislation. We really are in a position to move forward. And as the caller says, it's a no-brainer. Look, we can make the planet cleaner. We can avoid catastrophic impacts for our children and grandchildren and provide these wonderful new jobs, these clean energy jobs. When you poll the American public, they are overwhelmingly in support of a clean energy transition. And I think we're going to see that over the next couple of years. So, yes, there are lots of tipping points that we fear with the climate tipping points, like the collapse of the ice sheets or the release of greenhouse gases stored in the permafrost. Yes, there are these potential tipping points that we could cross in the future when it comes to the science, when it comes to the climate change itself. But there is a societal tipping point that I think we're going through now that is, in my view, grounds for cautious optimism that we're rounding the corner now. And look, as awful as 2020 was, as awful a year as it was, we may well look back at 2020 as the year where we really did fundamentally turn the corner in acting on the climate crisis.
I want to circle back to Greta Thunberg, who you mentioned earlier, and this younger generation and what they are putting on the table here. Called her infectious. She sparked a global youth movement. What do you see out of these teenagers, this younger generation? What can they do?
Well, they get it, and they're not afraid to speak truth to power. They've grown up in an environment, this modern social media environment where it's natural to engage and to try to impact the public conversation, and they've done so in a profound way, and so they've really shifted the conversation. Now they're not in a position, right? The younger folks aren't in a position themselves to affect the changes that we need to see. They don't have the reins of power. They don't control our policy apparatus. They can't vote. The vast majority of the folks I'm talking about aren't yet of voting age, but what they're doing, what is within their power to shift the conversation and to put pressure on the rest of us. It is our responsibility. They've given us a foot in the door. It is our responsibility now to pry that door open and walk through and to make sure that we do demand accountability of our politicians, that we do take the necessary measures to reduce our carbon emissions collectively, that we do act on this crisis before it is truly too late. There is still time to do that. That's the good news. But there is great urgency in acting now.
We're talking with Michael Mann, the author of The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. And you can join in with your questions about the changing climate, what you see, what you've experienced, and where you want policy to go. What do you want to happen in industry? You can email ideas@WPR.org, tweet us at WPR Mornings. We heard from Doug in Milwaukee, email to ask, why don't we use nuclear power for electricity? What is holding back nuclear, Doug asks?
Yeah, it's a good question, Doug. It's one that I address in the book. Look, I have friends, colleagues who I respect greatly, who believe that nuclear energy is an important part of the sort of the clean energy revolution, an important climate solution. I'm a bit skeptical, I have to say, for a number of reasons. First of all, there are other clean energy options that are already completely within our grasp, solar, wind, geothermal. There are credible studies now in the literature that demonstrate a path forward where we could meet 80% of projected global electricity demand by 2030 entirely from those renewable sources and efficiency measures, and 100% by 2050. That's without nuclear energy. Now, nuclear energy comes with some risks, and we know what those are: proliferation, environmental, acute environmental threat. I live not far, less than an hour from Three Mile Island, where we had a meltdown decades ago here in Pennsylvania, a reminder of the risks that come with nuclear energy. And look, an argument could be made it's not actually necessary. Other clean energy can be scaled up quickly on the time frame necessary. And look, if you're a free market conservative, and I have friends who are, who I respect greatly, who believe in sort of market-driven solutions to problems like this, if that's your view, that this is, you know, that we need free market solutions to this problem, then nuclear energy wouldn't be your preference because it requires huge government subsidies. It's not competitive in the market against other energy sources on its own. It requires massive government investment. So if you're a small government person, if you don't believe in big government, then it would be ironic to really demand that we put a lot of government funding behind nuclear energy when, as I said, it comes with some real risks and it probably isn't necessary.
Michael Mann, sketch out for us, if you would, Charles and David Koch, the Koch brothers, as we know them. What is their position in this crisis?
Well, yeah, now there's just one of them, of course. David Koch passed away last year. And so there's sort of the Koch, remaining Koch brother, Charles Koch. But the two of them, the Koch brothers, have probably had a greater negative impact on not just the politics of climate change in this country by funding front groups and organizations whose role it was to discredit the scientific evidence, to discredit scientists like myself, and to sabotage any policy efforts in the states as well at the national level to move away from fossil fuel energy to renewable energy. And, you know, the motive is pretty clear. They're libertarian in their politics. They don't believe in, you know, governmental solutions to problems. But moreover, Koch Industries is the largest privately held fossil fuel interest in the world. And so those two individuals have probably done more harm than just about anybody else when it comes to efforts to act on climate. The good news is that their influence seems to be subsiding. People seem to be moving on. Denial, outright climate denial, is sort of in its death throes now. But they do, and other plutocrats and fossil fuel organizations and front groups continue to promote attacks, not so much on the science, but on our efforts to actually do something about the problem.
Penn State Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science Michael Mann explaining climate change, the influences, how special interest groups, the fossil fuel industry, as we've been talking about, seek to undermine climate action, maybe in subtle ways we may not recognize. Do you have faith that what we've done to our planet can be undone? Still time to talk. Email ideas at WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back in a minute with Michael Mann here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for being here. Let's get back to our conversation with Penn State climatologist Michael Mann. He writes, the climate crisis is very real, but it is not unsolvable, and it's not too late to act. Every ounce of carbon we don't burn makes things better. Michael, you've talked about, you know, wind, solar, geothermal. On the issue of geothermal, Gary from Iron River is wanting to know about what studies have been done on geothermal power and the consequences of extracting heat from the earth. Is this technique safe?
Oh, yeah, well, thanks. It's a fair question. We always have to ask these sorts of questions anytime, you know, we're talking about scaling up a given technology. Yes, there is absolutely no scientific reason to think that you know, geothermal energy and tapping into it is a problem. As far as our climate is concerned, the amount of heat energy escaping from the solid earth up to the surface of the planet is pretty minuscule. So it's not an important part of sort of the energy balance that determines our climate, but there is enough of that energy that we can tap into it and use it. And, you know, how the relative sort of utility or viability of different types of renewable energy obviously varies depending on the state. Solar, wind, geothermal. There's a great report that you should turn to. It's the Climate Solutions Project, spearheaded by a Stanford colleague of mine, Mark Jacobson. But the project itself has heavy hitters like Mark Ruffalo, the Incredible Hulk in the Marvel movies, who have helped promote.
Also a native of Wisconsin, I might add. Carry
on. I did not know that.
I'll help you out there.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's awesome. He's actually a good friend. He's a wonderful person as well as a great actor. What the report shows is how a path forward to, again, 80% renewable energy by the end of this decade and 100% renewable energy by mid-century, and the path forward in each of the states, what sources of renewable and clean energy make the most sense given the specifics of the state. And there's a whole, you know, section on Wisconsin, and I would encourage folks to check that out. I have to give one more shout out here. The University of Wisconsin-Madison has some of the best climate scientists and climate policy experts in the world. And so folks in Wisconsin should definitely take advantage of your own academic community and the University of Wisconsin that does wonderful work in this area.
Indeed, indeed we do. What, as you do these shout outs, what strategies should environmentalists and others who care about this issue, what strategies should they take in the action right now in the climate war?
Yeah, so I provide sort of a 5-point plan, battle plan, as it were, in the book, and I'll let people check that out. But the basic point is fight the disinformation. Don't spend all your time arguing with climate change deniers. They're a small fringe now, and they'd gladly waste all your time. But do, you know, focus on people in the middle, honest folks who are confused by the misinformation, because a little bit of information and resources can really help move them along so that they become more engaged in this problem. We have to support the youth who have, you know, devoted their lives to make us change our ways so that we don't destroy the planet for them and future generations, but they're not in a position of power themselves. So we need to be that for them. We need to help make sure that their efforts are not in vain. And talk about the problem, talk about climate change, demand accountability on the part of your policymakers, your politicians, both the local level, the state level, the national level. It's an issue that we have to vote on. We saw this in this last election. We saw, you know, Joe Biden campaigned on climate. He's got a mandate to lead on climate. And we've already seen now, just as, you know, in the various people that he's appointed to the different cabinet positions and to run the various agencies, that he's incorporating climate action throughout the entire administration. And we'll be able to work hand in hand with a Congress that will be in a position to actually do something now. So there is good news, but it won't happen if we don't continue to apply pressure. Politicians like to take the path of least resistance. It's the squeaky wheel. So make sure we're out there holding them accountable. Yes, do all those things you can do in your everyday life to reduce your own personal environmental footprint. Often saves us money, makes us healthier, makes us feel better, sets a great example for others. But that alone isn't going to be enough to solve this problem. We need policymakers to support climate-friendly policies, and we need to do it now.
Michael Mann with us, director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State, where he's a professor of atmospheric science. Michael, we had an email here from Mike who wants to say that it appears China is moving toward using hydrogen fuel cells to power things like their buses and their trucks. What are your thoughts on that power source, on fuel cells, hydrogen fuel cells?
Yeah, so it's, you know, been one of those technologies we've been talking about a lot for some time. You know, always seemed to be around the corner. It was never really realized, but I think there are some important technological innovations that have happened there that may make it viable. And of course, the challenge here is to make sure that the energy technology that we're using doesn't generate more carbon pollution because of manufacturing or, extractor, whatever else we have to do to make that technology. So we always have to look at the full life cycle of a given energy technology to make sure that it really is carbon friendly. But certainly hydrogen fuel cells are one of the potential, you know, solutions, clean energy solutions that are out there. And here's the thing, you know, technology is going to give us all sorts of new solutions, and it's going to increase the efficiency of existing clean energy solutions in the years ahead. So we need to continue to push on with that innovation, with that research and the development of new technology. But we can move forward now with the technology we already have. And that's the important thing about the Climate Solutions Project. It demonstrates that even without any additional technological innovation, just with the technologies that are already in our hands, we can solve the problem.
So we have the tools. I want to take a quick look here at the $900 billion COVID relief package approved last month. It included a number of climate change measures. How significant were these measures?
Hugely significant for two reasons, really. First of all, it's a non-trivial amount of investment, $35 billion in that stimulus package for clean energy. So, you know, we wouldn't call it a climate bill. And ultimately, we will need comprehensive climate legislation that incentivizes subsidies for renewables, that puts a price on carbon. These are all things that we'll need to do if we're going to achieve the reductions that we need. But this is certainly a step in the right direction, and it demonstrates that there actually is the potential for climate-friendly legislation, that there's some good faith out there. And with this latest election, we still don't know what the fallout is of the politics of everything that's happened and continues to happen right now. But it may very well be that we'll be in a position where there will be, you know, maybe a half dozen to a dozen Republicans who will be willing to join with Democrats to advance climate legislation in the years ahead. And that'll obviously be synergistic with an administration that is using its executive authority to implement climate action across the entire government, federal government. And so it's a good time if you're looking for reasons to be cautiously optimistic that we're turning the corner. This is a good time. There is urgency, but once again, there is clearly agency. We can do this.
As we wrap up here, you know, you work on such a challenging, vexing, depressing issue at times. What gives you hope? How do you keep this work up?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I'll tell you, the kids, a big part of it is sort of the youth climate movement. I've got a daughter who's 15 years old. You know, I want to make sure that our generation doesn't destroy the planet for her, her children, grandchildren. And so they give me, you know, they both inspire me because it's really about preserving this planet for them. But they inspire me because of the actions that they've taken, that they've really taken hold of the larger public conversation about climate. And part of the reason that we're seeing, you know, forward movement now is because of them and their efforts.
Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure, Kate.
Michael Mann is a distinguished professor of atmospheric science, director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State. His new book is called The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.